Okay, good afternoon, everybody, or good morning still. Wednesday, October 27th, 11:17. And we're starting spectroscopy today. So I'm just going to kind of jump into spectroscopy and let's talk a minute about these different forms. Spectroscopy is a catch-all term. It used to mean light spectrum, right? So spectroscopy was using different types of electromagnetic radiation in order to observe molecules and to get information about molecules. So spectroscopy is kind of a catch-all, and we use spectroscopy for almost all the different forms of analysis, even though they're not all electromagnetic radiation that we deal with. So it's sort of a catch-all phrase. There's three main types that we're going to be looking at. So we're going to be looking at NMR first. Nuclear magnetic resonance. And nuclear magnetic resonance, what it looks at is it looks at the nucleus the nucleus spin state. It operates on radio frequencies. And it gives us information about chemical environments. And we could say on the chemical environment of the observed nucleus. IR is infrared spectroscopy. This looks at bond vibrations within the molecule. So it's bond vibrational frequencies. As its name implies, it uses infrared light. And it's giving us information on functional groups. And then lastly, we have mass spec. And mass spectrometry is sometimes we abbreviate it. I guess I could abbreviate it MS. So if I keep going with the way that I'm doing things here, look at MS, mass spectrometry. This is time of flight. Of charged particle. And I say particle because it can be a whole molecule or it could be a part of a molecule. And basically what we do is we look at the mass to charge ratio. That's really what it gives out. And so how it operates, I guess I'm not structuring this, if I want to be consistent in the way that I'm structuring it, it's information on mass to charge ratio. The way that it operates is it operates on ionization using different techniques. And then those ions travel through a ions travel through a magnetic field. And what comes out is information on the mass to charge ratio of the particles. Or could be molecules. And so this mass to charge ratio is what we say MZ ratio, where M equals mass and Z equals charge. And the real piece that we're trying to get out of this, the key piece, is what we call the molecular ion mass. We give that a capital M dot positive charge, and that piece is the molecular weight of the molecule. And that molecular weight is so, with so much accuracy, that from the molecular weight, we can determine the molecular formula. And so out of these different pieces of information, mass spec gives us the molecular weight and the molecular formula. IR tells us about what functional groups are present in the molecule, which is backup information for the NMR, which tells us both functional groups and chemical environment. It gives us atom connectivity of how the atoms are actually connected together. And so really, most of the time, NMR and mass spec are enough to figure out what a molecule is. IR is sort of reinforcement and backup and can act as a fingerprint or verification for the information. So IR
is cheaper, right?
Oh, and IR is super cheap, yeah, compared to mass spec and NMR. An NMR machine can cost anywhere from hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars. A mass spec instrument can be several hundreds thousand dollars. An IR instrument is a couple thousand. And so in terms of the cost of the instrument, the IR is the cheapest of the instruments, but also in terms of the time investment and sample preparation, IR is the easiest out of all of the instruments. So just cost and ease, IR gives you a quick picture of what the molecule has in it functional group wise, but NMR and mass spec are really much, much more important. So what we're going to do is we're going to bounce around. We're going to do NMR first. I think we'll hit mass spec. We'll come back and we'll touch on IR. And IR we've done pretty much from the lab, and we have a pretty good understanding of what IR does and is, but it's the NMR and mass spec that we need to deal with. So the first part we'll deal with NMR, second part we'll deal with mass spec. Okay, any questions? Where we're going, what we're doing? All right, let's take a look at NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance. And what I'm gonna try to do is give you a bit of some background on how it works. The how it works is not so important to understanding how to read NMR, but I feel like if you're going to use an instrument, you should understand what that instrument is actually doing and have some fundamental understanding of what it is that you're looking at so that you can understand how it works. So what we do with NMR is we take a sample, and that sample is usually on the order of 20 milligrams in that range, and we put that sample into a long tube. So NMR tubes are these very long, skinny tubes. And usually what you do is you put about 20 milligrams of sample and about three fingers width. It's the best way that I can describe it because we never measure it. And so basically what you do is you line up your fingers here and about three fingers worth of solvent in this thing. And there's a little NMR cap that fits in this. And then there's a collar that we put around it. And the collar is usually a plastic piece. And it has little markings on the outside of it. That thing then is taken and it's put inside an instrument. And the instrument is basically a giant thermos. And so the instruments generally have an appearance that they're a big metal unit. They can be quite large. They're usually up on a big stand. And so when you walk up to the instrument may be relative to a person. The instrument may be quite large. The sample goes up in here and sits inside here. And when you put it inside the instrument, the detection component is way deep down inside. And so what happens is there's a tube that this sits inside. And so that the device does not just drop down into the bottom of the tube, there is a motor that it is hooked to and a pump and a burst of air lifts this thing, and the collar is there so that the air can actually push the tube up and hold it. And then when you release the air, the thing falls very slowly into the device. And what's inside this, when I said it's a giant thermos, what's inside this giant thermos is generally two cores. There's generally an inner core and an outer core. And so in here, they put liquid helium. And then in the outer core out here, they put liquid nitrogen. And the reason that they use both is because liquid nitrogen isn't cold enough on its own, that this works on a very, very large magnetic field. And it's a superconducting magnet that is inside this device. In order for that magnet to maintain superconductivity, it has to be kept ultra cold. And so the superconducting magnet component resides in here in the liquid helium component, and the liquid nitrogen on the outside is an initial sort of cooling bath, and then you have this ultra cold liquid helium that sits inside it. And on most of these devices, what they have is a little tube at the top, and there's an ice cone that develops on top of these tubes. And these are vent tubes in order to allow, as the material that's inside here, as the material evaporates and discharges, it releases pressure out these tubes, and ice forms on these because as the cooling gases come through it, they capture all the water moisture that's in the air, and ice just keeps forming on these things. And so you know that they're actually in good shape when you see the ice cones on the outside of these cooling vents that are there. Okay, so once the sample goes down into the detector, then it looks kind of like this. There's a... there is our tube that fits in here. It's got that collar on it. The collar sits up close to the top. The sample is sitting down here in the bottom. And as it falls down into the detector, there is a series of wire coils that it fits down into. And these wire coils go to a transmitter and a receiver. And then there are a series of magnetic plates, the superconducting magnetic plates, that are tunable and movable. And this is a transmitter. And receiver. A burst of air causes this thing to rotate. And what we go through is a number of series of steps. Number one, we rotate the sample. Number two, we do a process that's called shimming, which is trying to make the magnetic field homogeneous. And then we do acquisition, which is a series of radio frequency transmissions. And receiving. So what we do is we do a pulse sequence. So here what we're doing is we're excitation. And then this is listening or relaxation. And so this will be repeated hundreds to thousands of times in the sequence in order to, each one of these is an acquisition sequence where we excite the nuclei and then listen to the nuclei, excite, listen. And we do that many, many, many times over in order to increase the signal to noise ratio and to get a good scan. And then the fourth step is really the data workup. And that is taking what we call the free induction decay. We refer to that as a FID. That FID is a signal that has a beat pattern to it, where this is time, and this is amplitude. And then we convert that free induction decay through a process of Fourier transform. And we convert it into a line spectrum. And that's the basic process. But what's happening to the nuclei when we do this excitation, and why does the nuclei actually respond to radio frequencies and these transmissions and these, and then what does it do when it's giving back out a signal? So if we think about the nuclei as a sphere, and we look at the different nuclei that are sitting here, the nuclei may have all different spin states. So these are not molecules. These are just individual atoms, and they may be attached in a molecule. What we do is we take and we put them into a magnetic field. And the magnetic field has this particular orientation. And what that does is it takes each one of these nuclei and it aligns the nuclei with the magnetic field so that the nuclei are now all aligned, which is actually not entirely true. The picture is that really some of the nuclei, let me put in another three atoms here, some of the nuclei don't align with the magnetic field. And so these nuclei are still sort of doing their own thing. But what we
get, is it molecular geometry?
It's not. It's really about the energy between excited and ground state. And the energy is so small that even with a small amount of thermal excitation, these molecules don't all go into the excited state or don't all go into the ground state. Some of them just happen to be in the excited state. So what we do is we get slightly more than 50% are in ground state. Which means that we have really horrible signal to noise ratio, that because you can only analyze a small portion of the molecules, because you can only get a small portion of the molecules or a small portion of the atoms into the ground state aligned with the magnetic field, slightly more than 50%, when you excite them, you've only got slightly more than 50% that are going to relax. And so your signal is diminished by having just a small number of molecules that are actually going through the excitation and the relaxation. Okay, but what happens to an individual nuclei? So let's say that the nuclei is in the ground state. What happens is this nuclei, when it is excited through a radio frequency, it accepts that energy and it tips, and the nucleus is spinning. And when it tips, it precesses. So if you think about a precession isn't a rotation. The rotation is where this thing is spinning on its axis. But now the axis is tipped and it is spinning. And what's happening is that little magnetic vector is now not staying stationary. That little magnetic vector is actually spinning on an angle, and that's higher energy. And what happens is it relaxes over time and it goes back to its ground state. And so what happens is basically when you take a nuclei and you put it into a magnetic field, let's do it this way. That's what I want to do. Let's put it into a magnetic field. Then it splits it into two different possible states. Its ground state, where it's aligned, and its excited state, where it precesses. And this difference in energy is very small. And when we put in that radio frequency, the radio frequency comes in and is the excitation frequency. We can represent that with light, but it's radio frequency. And what that does is it kicks this guy up, and then it relaxes, and then it gives out energy, which is proportional to the difference in the ground state versus the excited state. So really, the magnetic field, all the magnetic field does is allow us to be able to see the differences between the ground state and the excited state. And then it's a radio frequency that is on the order of the nuclear transition. And so there is no radiation involved in nuclear magnetic resonance. The nuclear just defines that we're looking at a nucleus. That's all it is. So nuclear doesn't mean radiation. Nuclear means nucleus. And this is nothing more than magnetic fields and radio waves. And so there's nothing safer than doing NMR. And it's funny because you walk into an NMR facility and the first thing they have you do is take your wallet out, take your watches off, take any keys that are out of your pockets and set them down. Because when you walk up to this instrument has such a high magnetic field in it that it'll erase credit cards. So when you walk up to it, it'll neutralize all the credit cards in your pocket. It'll magnetize your watch and throw your watch off. It will do all kinds of damage. And in fact, if you were to bump into this instrument or bang into this instrument at all, it loses its magnetic field and it loses it in a, what do they call it? It's a
quench.
It is a quench, but there's another word for it where you have this pulse that it releases this electromagnetic pulse. And that electromagnetic pulse, when it releases, is so much energy that it will fry every computer within several rooms distance from the NMR. Actually happened in grad school when I was there. One of my colleagues bumped into the NMR, fell into it late at night, tipped it, knocked it, fried every computer within three rooms. Just toasted the hard drives. You want to talk about getting in trouble? That dude was in trouble.
And everybody talks like Mickey Mouse.
Yeah. It actually doesn't. Well, if the nitrogen is to get out or the helium is to get out, yes. But that doesn't happen so much. When you tip it, when you knock into it, the Dewar has a lot of slop room in there. No fluid is lost. But the act of when you change a magnetic field and you take, it's like when you try to take a bicycle tire and the tire is spinning and you try to turn the tire, there's this resistance to moving and this energy that has to be expelled when you move it. And it always tries to go back to its position. When you do that with a magnetic field, the magnetic field loses because there's an electric field that's associated with it. It discharges that magnetic field and that electric field. And then that just goes out in a pulse of energy that then wreaks havoc on all the computer drives that are around or any electronics that are nearby. So the computers to these, when you look at the computer that sits next to this that you work on, that computer and the box usually sits in what's called a Faraday cage. And a Faraday cage is, I'm exaggerating sort of what this looks like, but what happens is they put the electronics usually in a Faraday cage that is a wire mesh material that absorbs electromagnetic pulses. So should the electromagnetic pulse actually occur, it gets blocked by the Faraday cage and the Faraday cage absorbs the magnetic field and the electric field and distributes it to ground and thereby protecting the computer. So all the computers are protected by Faraday cages around these guys. Okay, so that's a bit about what how NMR works. The other part about this is that only certain nuclei are NMR active. So I equals spin state, or is it the spin, what do we call it? It's not spin state. It's the spin of the nucleus. So I shouldn't say spin state, I should just say spin of nucleus. And I equal to odd numbers, 1/2, 2/3. I don't know if there's anything else. These are NMR active. Spin states where I is even are inactive. So if you look at a couple of different nuclei, for instance, hydrogen one. Let me do, I value nuclei. Let's do the I value. Hydrogen one has an I value of 1/2. Hydrogen two has an I value of 1. Carbon 12 has an I value of 1. Carbon 13 has an I value of 1/2. Nitrogen 14 has an I value of 1. Nitrogen 15 has an I value of 1/2. And I think another one, there's boron 10 and boron 11. I believe it's the boron 10 has 3/2. I have to look and see what boron 11 is. I'm gonna leave that one out. And so the ones that are NMR active are these guys here that have the odd spin states. And the other nuclei are not NMR active and cannot be observed. And so we can't look at H2 deuterium. We can't look at carbon 12. We can only look at carbon 13. And so here's the other thing that's interesting. These are percent of molecules, the isotopic abundance, the relative abundance, percent relative abundance. And let me get the actual numbers because I don't have them on my chart, but I think that hydrogen is almost 99. Yeah, 99.985%. H2 is only 0.015%. Carbon 12 is 98.9%. Carbon 13 is 1.1%. Nitrogen 14 is 99.6%. And nitrogen 15 is 0.366%. Boron is relatively, it's not. This is 19.9%. And B11 is what is 80.1%. So there's a problem here in that when we're looking at hydrogen, we're observing the most abundant isotope of hydrogen. But when we're observing carbon, we're observing the least abundant species. And so trying to do carbon NMR is challenging, is difficult, because there's so few molecules and only 50% of all the carbon atoms can be excited and then listened to. And so not only is it that 1.1% of all carbons are carbon 13, but then only 50% of those can actually be queried. And so it takes a long time to do carbon NMR, whereas hydrogen NMR, proton NMR is really fast. So this can be done fast, but this one is really slow. So is nitrogen. Nitrogen is really slow too. Boron actually is pretty fast, but the rest of these, nitrogen and carbon, are really hard to do. And there are some other nuclei that are active, but these are the main ones that tend to be observed. It's carbon, it's proton, it's nitrogen, it's boron, phosphorus sometimes. But these are the main things that we're looking at. And so there are issues with trying to do NMR just in the relative amounts of each one of the atoms. Okay, when I had represented the difference between the excited state and the ground state, most people will choose to represent this a different way. most people will represent it this way, as being an arrow that is flipped. And so what you're looking at is you're looking at the magnetic field and you're seeing opposite the magnetic field and you're seeing alignment with the magnetic field. This is how most people represent it. This is actual. So actual is about precession, whereas most people just find it easier to represent it as a true flipping of the magnetic moment and it opposing the magnetic field as being the excited state. Regardless of how you talk about it, the important part is, what is the difference in energy between these two? So what is the delta energy? The delta energy for hydrogen, it's different for every element, but for hydrogen, for H1, it's about 20,000, excuse me, megahertz. And we're demonstrating that energy in hertz, in cycles per second. So in cycles per second, H1 equals 200 million, that's mega, cycles per second. And so what we typically do is we typically look at megahertz as opposed to magnetic field. So when we start to look at magnetic field and energy, what we do is we usually do a graph or demonstrate a graph that looks kind of like this. We start off at a zero point. Come on, that was supposed to snap in a line. And each one of these is the difference between the ground state and the excited state. And what we're looking at is we're looking at Gauss and energy, in the difference in energy essentially between these states. So when we go to Gauss, a magnetic field that is about 1400 Gauss, the difference in energy here, and this is for proton, so this is for H1, the difference in energy here is about 60 megahertz. When we go to a Gauss that is 47,000 Gauss magnetic field, the difference in energy increases between the ground state and the excited state. The stronger the magnetic field, the bigger the difference between the ground state and the excited state. And so this goes to 200 megahertz. When we go up to, 84,500? Then this difference goes to about 360. So instruments, when we look at an instrument, an NMR instrument, are rated by the change in energy between excited and ground state for a proton. So they're rated 60 megahertz, 200 megahertz, 360 megahertz, or 500 megahertz. And instruments now are over a gigahertz. So it's possible to get gigahertz instruments. The bigger the magnetic field, the bigger the difference in the energy between the ground state and the excited state, the bigger the energy, or I should just write this down, higher magnetic field equals larger energy difference. Between excited and ground. The bigger that energy difference is, the more atoms in ground state. That means that we have more atoms that can be excited. That means we get more signal, fewer acquisitions needed. And less sample. That's less time doing the experiment. And more data from the experiment, we get more fine data from the experiment, more detail from the experiment. However, when you go up in magnet, you know what happens to the cost? So a 60 megahertz instrument, this is what's called a fixed magnet instrument. Megahertz is also fixed. These two fixed instruments run roughly $120,000. And the magnet doesn't need superconducting. The magnet is a magnet just like you might see in a really big speaker. It's just a fixed magnet and no cryogenics needed. By the time you get above 90 megahertz and you start getting into 200, 250, and on up to 500, on up to 1 gigahertz. These instruments all require cryogenics. And I don't even know what the cost of these things are, but they've got to be, this one's got to be close to $1 million. And I don't even know what dollar signs are on that guy in terms of a gigahertz. They're really expensive instruments by the time you get up that far. But what you can do is that an acquisition on a 60 or 90 megahertz instrument for proton NMR or carbon NMR, it may take you 30 minutes. It may take you 2 days. To get a decent carbon NMR. Even at the 200 megahertz cycle, we would oftentimes spend 15 minute acquisitions to get proton, but they may spend a day or two still trying to get a really good carbon NMR. If you had a really concentrated sample, you could do the carbon NMR in an hour or two. But now you've got like 2 minutes and 30 minutes in terms of a 500 NMR. So what was taking you a couple of days before on this instrument can be done in 30 minutes on that instrument. And so the cost is really in the amount of time that people spend on the instrument and what you can do with it and what you can observe. And so there's huge benefits to using a much higher magnetic field, although it's just a much, much greater expense. So just understanding the instruments a little bit and what's entailed in these instruments. Okay, so I did mention a little bit about the signal that comes out. And that signal, I said, had a name, and it oftentimes has sort of this beat pattern, and the beat pattern gets smaller and smaller as you go on. And sometimes the beat pattern is really distinct. This is time, and this is amplitude, I guess. This is what's called the free induction decay. And it represents, in that period, in that pulse sequence, it represents what's happening in the relaxation phase. So we said that these are excitation, and this is listening. That listening is where the FID comes in. That's the free induction decay. And what that is the energy that is coming out of all of the different chemical environments for each nuclei that we're listening to. And then that needs to be deconvoluted through a mathematical process, a Fourier transform. And the Fourier transform, when we go through that, converts that signal into an NMR signal that we read as a line spectrum. And that line spectrum has has parts per million and generally what we have is zero on the right hand side, and for proton goes up to about 14 parts per million, and then this is an amplitude still, which is most of the time not used. It's really the parts per million. So PPM, or sometimes this is put in as delta, parts per million. And this equals chemical shift. In parts per million. And what we get is a series of lines that can have different patterns. And those lines tell us about the chemical environment and the numbers of different types of protons. Let's say that this is proton NMR. So these guys here are the types of protons, and often how many of each type. And one more piece of information, number of neighbors. How many H's are next to them is information that comes out of this as well. And so all of that information is encoded in this parts per million, but the hard part is how do I wrap my brain around what parts per million actually is and what do we mean by parts per million? Well, parts per million, when we take chemical shift and parts per million, this equals the frequency of the sample minus the frequency of the reference. Usually this is tetramethylsilane, TMS, and all of that gets divided by the frequency applied. And then that gets multiplied by 10 to the sixth. And that equals parts per million. And the reason that we multiply it by 10 to the sixth and we do it in parts per million is because this top part is really, really small. And this bottom part is super large. So we're applying frequencies that are in megahertz. So these guys are in megahertz and these guys are in hertz. And so to get it into meaningful numbers, we represent it as taking the hertz divided by megahertz, and then we multiply it by 10 to the sixth. And that literally is parts per million. And so that's why it's represented as parts per million. It's just to bring it into numbers between 0 and 14 so that we can deal with small whole numbers. But that's what the parts per million really means. So it's just parts per million, just like you would in concentrations with chemicals. When we're dealing with chemicals that are very, very dilute, we do parts per million so that they can be reasonable numbers to deal with. Same thing here for megahertz. We're just taking the megahertz and the hertz signal and converting it into parts per million. Okay, so with all of that in place, and we're looking at parts per million, then let's define what is actually happening
if we were to see like the results of a spectrum, I guess. Then we would see it in either units of delta or units of ppm, and would we assume that those are the same?
They're the same. Delta and ppm are the same thing. Okay. So when we say that it's represented in parts per million or it's represented in delta, which is used as chemical shift. So we say delta. Remember what delta means. Delta means small difference. And so that's what this is small difference, right? V sample minus V reference, small difference. So parts per million and delta are used to mean the same thing. Sometimes it's labeled as ppm, sometimes it's labeled as delta. But whatever it's labeled, it means parts per million, and that's what the numbers represent.
Cool, thanks.
Yeah. Okay. I think what I need to do next, let's talk about the reference. Reference compound TMS. This is tetramethylsilane. Because of the electronegativity of silicon is electrodonating. So what's happening is the silicon is actually pushing electron density as an electron donating group inductively towards the carbon and towards the protons. So what that means is that these carbons and these protons have more electron density around them than do other types of protons and carbons. What this does is it sets up our zero point. And everything else, every other organic compound that we put in has less electrons around them. So basically what that is doing is that the silicon, in connecting to the carbon and connecting to these hydrogens, is pushing electron density towards them. And that electron density we call shielding. As we pack electron density around these guys, The electron density helps to isolate the nucleus from the magnetic field. We say it shields. From the B field. That in turn decreases the magnetic field. So basically what's happening is when we look at a proton, a couple of different things can happen. If we look at the ground state and the excited state, and let's say that we look at a proton that is out here that is a normal CH3 or a normal proton. And it's got just a little bit of electron density around it. That electron density, when we look at the magnetic field, this is the magnetic field, this is the electron density, this is B effective. B effective influences the difference here in energy. When we take and we take a proton that is connected through a carbon through a silicon, then the amount of electron density that is around this is much greater. And what winds up happening is the difference in energy between the excited state and the ground state gets decreased. Why does it get decreased? And why is this so small? And the answer is because now what happens is, here's my magnetic field, but my electronic vector is much larger. And so what happens is B effective is really tiny. So essentially, if we go back to this picture represents increasing magnetic field. And when we increase magnetic field, we increase the distance between the ground state and the excited state. But we can look at this not just as an effect of the magnet that we choose to use in the NMR instrument. We can look at this as changes in chemical environment for a proton. So if we lock in the magnetic field here, some of these are going to be shielded by electron density, and some of these are going to be deshielded by electron density. And we will get differences in the excitation frequencies for the different protons based on the chemical environment that they're in. And so what happens is things that are like silicon that are electron donating cause the effective field to be small and the difference in energy to be small. And things that have less electron density around them have a larger B effective. We can even exaggerate this so I can shrink this down a little bit and say I've got just a small amount of electron density and that maybe this guy is even a little bit bigger. So I've got a large effective field. And thereby I get larger signal. So this is what is referred to as shielding. And I don't have enough room there, but where do I want to put it? I'll just put it here. So what effect does this shielding have then? When we look at shielding and we look at an NMR spectrum, come on, why is it doing that? Better, okay. And this is parts per million. And this is zero. This is TMS as a reference. This is 14. Things that are down this direction are called shielded. things that are down this direction are referred to as deshielded. So things that are up this way are next to electron donating groups. Proton that is next to an electron donating group that has a very tiny partial positive on it. Things that are down this direction are protons that are next to electron withdrawing groups that have very large partial positives on them. And so the chemical environment, this is what is referred to as the chemical environment. Because all of a sudden now, we can tell that in this range over here, these are protons that are connected to carbons, different types of carbons. But as we get down into this range, this might be a range where protons are connected to oxygens, or this might be a range where protons are connected to things like carboxylic acids. And so we have little tiny partial positives, larger partial positive, very large partial positive. And it's about how much electron density is being stripped away from the proton and how deshielded the proton is. We also give another term to this. We call this upfield and downfield. So upfield, shielded are used interchangeably. Downfielded, deshielded are used interchangeably. But now, at least you're starting to get the essence of how we can tell where different protons show up. And it's about shielding versus deshielding and the chemical environment in which the proton actually sits. Now we're dealing with proton, so all of this is in reference to HNMR. But carbon NMR isn't any different. Carbon NMR is actually exactly the same. There's shielding and deshielding and upfield and downfield. The only thing that changes is the parts per million because carbon has a different excitation frequency. A carbon NMR is the same principle. It just runs on a different scale. So when we look at C13 NMR, we still have zero, and this is still TMS, and this is parts per million. But this runs out to about 240. And instead of running out to 14, the carbon runs out to 240. And so even if the spectrum is not labeled as carbon or proton, you can still tell whether it's a carbon or proton simply by looking at the chemical shift and what is the chemical shift on the full scale. And if that chemical shift is going out to 220 or 240, sometimes it goes out to 220. Sometimes proton only goes out to 12. Depending upon who's running the instrument or how far they're running it out, but they just have their own individual parts per million. And these are carbons that are alkyl. This might be a carbon which is connected to a halogen. This might be a carbon of a carbonyl. And so we're looking at very tiny partial positive. We have a larger partial positive and a very large partial positive. And it's the same idea of downfield and upfield, shielded and deshielded, in terms of how to read what's going on with the spectrum. Okay, questions so far? Anything?
So the shielding is growing with the as the electrons get less dense.
As electron density is pulled away from the atom, the atom loses that ability to resist the magnetic field that is applied to it. That creates a bigger difference in energy. And as we get a bigger difference, then we get a bigger parts per million. Okay.
Well, then I have a question. So then shielding is used to gain resolution on specifics of parts of the molecule?
What I would say is that the magnet we choose a larger magnet to be able to get more resolution. The shielding is an inherent property of the molecule itself and different aspects of parts of the molecule. And we leverage that when we put it into the magnetic field by understanding that different chemical environments will give different amounts of shielding. And we learn what that shielding looks like, where it comes in the parts per million scale. And then we know what chemical environment it sits in. So there are tables, and we will show tables that give the ranges for all the different types of protons and different types of carbons and where they show up based on experimentation and the fact that we've learned where they show up. And they follow a general trend, which is that the more electron withdrawing groups there are attached, the farther downfield the signal shows up. Okay.
Okay. Can we describe again what the chemical environment is?
Chemical environment is, that's a great question. And that's something that we actually spend quite a bit of time looking at, understanding how many different chemical environments there are. So let me, let's talk about chemical environment. Chemical environment just means that they are sitting in a different chemical environment. For instance, if I take a molecule, let me just draw a stick molecule here for a second. And we look at this molecule and we ask how many chemical environments there are in this molecule. What we have is a CH3 group. Hang on, set my desk down. What we have is a CH3 group connected to another CH3 group here. This guy is connected to a CH2 and another CH3. And there's a proton that is on here. So if I'm looking at chemical environments, these two, by rotation and by their position in the molecule, are connected in the exact same chemical environment. They are both connected to the same carbon. And so this CH3 and this CH3 are one chemical environment. This CH3 that is out at the other end of the molecule is connected to something different. It's connected to a CH2 group. And so they are different in their chemical environments. They are the same group, they're both methyls, but they physically see different things. And so when I look at chemical environments, if I'm just looking at the protons, the way that I would label this out with protons is I would label out these guys out here as HAs, and they're all HAs. They're all the same.
Are they really the same, or are the ones that are like closest to each other temporarily like slightly different? Are they impacted just by their bonds, or are they impacted by their like proximal neighbors or whatever you want to call them?
They are actually chemically identical and cannot be distinguished from one another. And then there's an HB, and then there's two HCs, and then there are three HDs.
So London dispersion, kind of like electron pushing around things, are too small to see.
London dispersion happens between molecules, and that's part of what we're doing with putting it into solution and the homogeneity of the solution and the homogeneity of the magnetic field we don't see the London dispersion forces or any of those types of intermolecular forces. All we see are the intra issues within the molecule.
They're like orders of magnitude stronger or something.
Yeah, I guess we could say that. Okay, so I'm just going to color these guys all in here. These are all my HAs. I should just use a bigger marker. These are HCs. This guy will be HB. And then the last ones are HD. And so in this molecule, I would have 1, 2, 3, 4 proton environments. And if I wanted to look at carbon environments, this guy here, these two would be the same. So these would be carbon A. This would be carbon B, carbon C, and carbon D. And so there are also 4 carbon environments. Figuring out how many environments something has is a critical skill to understanding NMR. So if we can look at a molecule and we can figure out how many environments it has, then understanding the NMR becomes much, much easier. However, I'll put a caveat on that in that the number of carbon environments and the number of proton environments are not always the same. That sometimes you can have less carbon environments or less proton environments based on the symmetry of the molecule. All right. Let me start with just a couple of molecules. And then I think next time, next class, and maybe even in lab next time, we'll deal with chemical environments more. We'll do some exercises on chemical environments because it is such a critical skill. But let me show you that if we have a molecule, dichloroethane, 1,2-dichloroethane, and we look at the different spectrum that we expect for this, and I'll do both the proton NMR and the carbon NMR. What we get is we get one signal that is out at 3.75. And this is 0 TMS. And 0 TMS. And we get a signal that is out here at 44. And we get another little signal out here at 78. And that signal out there at 78 is a triplet. So these two protons and these two protons are in the exact same chemical environment because the molecule is symmetrical. So these guys here are showing up at 3.75. And the carbon with the chlorine on it is showing up at 44. So then the question is, what is that? Remember when I said we make the sample, we put 20 milligrams of sample in it and 3 fingers of solvent. If we're looking at protons and carbons, any solvent that we put in here would be way more than the 20 milligram sample. So what is this solvent? And why am I not seeing the solvent in the NMR? And the answer is you are seeing the solvent in the NMR. That's the solvent. So then the question is, why don't I see the solvent in the proton? Why am I only seeing the solvent in the carbon NMR?
Because it's aprotic?
It is aprotic. Which is a yes, but it's not aprotic in the way you think. It's aprotic in a different way. But yes, it's aprotic. You're there. You're on it. So NMR solvents. One of the most common NMR solvents is CdCl3, deuterated chloroform. So D equals H2. And if we go back to H2 and we look back here, H2 has a spin state of 1 and is not NMR active. It's invisible in the NMR. So it's aprotic by using deuterium instead of hydrogen. There's no hydrogen in the solvent, but I can't get away from carbon. And so the carbon, this carbon is what shows up at 78 ppm in the carbon NMR. So the solvents that we use are deuterated solvents. They're CdCl3, they're D2O, they are acetone, which is CD3 on each side, so it's a D6. They're all deuterated solvents. All the solvents that we use for NMR are similar solvents that we would use to do chemical reactions, except they have no protons on them. Or CD3OD, deuterated methanol. And so they're all specialty isotope solvents where there are no protons. It's all deuteriums. And that's what we use for the solvents. Okay, I'm running over time. I think that's about where I want to cut it. We'll come back and we'll start looking at these chemical shifts and start throwing it more together. But I think we've got the foundation for what we need. And now it's a matter of just exploring the NMRs and showing you layers of information that is imposed on top of the NMR, understanding chemical environments, and then starting to look at these layers of information, and then learning to read these things and to back translate into an actual structure. That's where we go from here.
So we're going to read the NMR chapter. At least,
I would suggest reading the NMR chapter. That would be a good idea. That'll definitely help as we go forward. And think about your questions. You know, as you're reading that chapter, as things are not making sense, or as you have questions, that's going to help inform the lecture as well. So that would be a good thing to do. All right. Thanks for a good lecture. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jason. Bye.
Bye.